Yellow daffodils he hoped wouldn't remind Marianne too much of High Point Farm, where they'd grown in wild profusion, multiplying each spring, bulbs planted by Corinne along the driveway, in the front lawn, out near the road. And hyacinth, too, Corinne had grown, cutting sprigs to bring into the house, the sweet smell, so sweet. And jonquils with their papery petals. In a glass vase, Patrick set these flowers on his single table to greet Marianne. So she'd exclaim as soon as she entered the room, "Oh, Patrick, how nice!" wiping lightly at her eyes. He dreaded her crying. He was not going to cry himself. Never cried. Couldn't remember the last time. When Prince had trampled him, practically knocked out his eye? Goddamn making him a freak for life? Still, no one's fault. In nature, no one's to blame. Snow after Easter. It doesn't seem fair, does it? Marianne was stirring a rich, dark minestrone soup in a battered pan on Patrick's hot plate, as Patrick set the table for their meal. She peered out the window where, in the streetlight below, damp snowflakes swirled like agitated moths. She hadn't sounded complaining, only wistful. Patrick said, incensed, "I don't much notice weather now. That's one thing I'm freed from. Now I'm not a farm kid." Farm kid just slightly mocking. For of course the Mulvaneys of High Point Farm had never been only just farmers. Marianne said, "I'll never change, I'm sure." Staring up at the sky, trying to figure what's coming. Patrick was briskly laying out plates on the table, a folding table in the center of the book-cluttered room that was his study. The plates, slightly chipped, were cobalt-blue stoneware of some well-known American stock, pressed upon him by Corinne when he'd moved to Ithaca. "But you have to eat off something. Why not something nice?" The thick-plied yellow-cloth napkins were from home, too, and the stainless steel cutlery with the chunky carved bone handles. Patrick said impatiently, "It's a relief not to have to care where you are. All that pride we had at home and anxiety, keeping up some kind of, I don't know, model family life. Not that we were aware of it, even Dad and Mom. Especially Dad and Mom. As soon as I left, I discovered how big the world is. You only have to reposition yourself in it. Where is just temporary. You'll be moving on." Making little speeches to his perplexed sister. He supposed he was overstating the case for her sake. "Look, you aren't missing much. Do I miss them?" Supposed that Marianne's presence in these cramped quarters where he was accustomed to being blissfully alone, in truth rarely thinking of back home, of them, of it, was making him say extravagant, asinine things he didn't exactly mean. Marianne, however, took every statement of Patrick's seriously. He remembered that from the past. Years, years, years of playing elder, smarter, more cynical brother to his adoring, unquestioning sister. It was flattering, but occasionally annoying. Provoking anger you could not predict when, like the hot, pounding anger he'd felt in the bus depot, seeing his sister, his only sister he loved, through the eyes of a sexual predator. Marianne was saying slowly, "I suppose I'm different. More literal. Every place I am, like now, the co-op and Kilburn, I can't think it's temporary. Even if I left, it would still be there, the place and the people." Patrick let the subject pass. He had yet to inquire much about the Green Isle Co-op, apart from knowing that it provided off-campus room and board for Marianne at Kilburn State, and that, by working there, she could defray 60% of her college costs. Just possibly he resented his sister's tender tone in speaking of it, and of the companion she'd known only the previous September, but clearly liked, very much. Brothers and sisters they were to her, apparently. Patrick knew the names. Abelove, Burke, Felice Marie, Val, Gilb, or was it Gelb? A mixed-breed spaniel named Teardrop. This information seemed to him more than sufficient. Patrick had wanted to take Marianne out to dinner that evening, to a Chinese restaurant on State Street, but she'd insisted she would make their meals while she was here. She'd seemed so emphatic over the phone he'd given in. "Though it's a lot of trouble for you to bring food on the bus, couldn't we buy it here?"
"Oh, Patrick, no."
Sounding almost hurt. In just Corinne's tone, if one or another of her children hadn't been hungry for a meal or hadn't wanted to take time to sit down at the table and eat with the family. So Marianne had brought with her on the Trailways bus, in the canvas bag, 2 quarts of a tomato-based soup stock, raw vegetables, and macaroni. 2 loaves of bread she'd baked herself, zucchini walnut and 9-grain whole wheat, a jar of Green Isle raspberry jam, even in a plastic bag salad greens and vegetables. Preparing the meal in Patrick's alcove kitchen, no stove but a double-burner hot plate, a squat little Pullman refrigerator on the floor, a small aluminum sink, a single counter and cupboard. She'd chatter to him, glowing with pleasure and purpose. Almost she was Button Mulvaney, if Patrick didn't stare at her. In the bus depot, God, he'd been shocked. The sight of her going through him like a sharp blade. Marianne? Was it possible? In the room here, when she'd removed her jacket, he'd swallowed hard. How thin she was. Upper arms no larger than his wrists. Collarbone jutting and breasts tiny as a 12-year-old's, and anyone who would gaze upon such a child with lust was sick, depraved, repellent. The spiky hair, brutally shorn at the back and sides, faint blue veins at her temples and eyes threaded with red as if she'd gone without sleep recently, or had been crying. Equally disturbing, the odd clothes. Discount store clothes. Like no clothes worn by Cornell students, even those eager to define themselves as characters, freaks. The flimsy white cotton t-shirt with the thin, loose straps, and in green stamped letters, Green Isle Co-op on the front. Sarcastically, Patrick asked, "Are you in disguise, Marianne?" "As what?" He'd meant to be funny, but Marianne only stared at him, confused. She touched her hair nervously as if trying to smooth it down. It occurred to him that she didn't know what she looked like. Patrick had read about rape victims. He'd done research in his methodical pinch style at the Cornell Psych Library. It is common for a rape victim, female or male, to avoid mirrors and direct confrontation with all images of the self. As if, where there had been a person, there is now no one. Patrick offered to help Marianne prepare supper, but she said she didn't need help. The minestrone was her own recipe, never the same twice. Patrick murmured he wasn't used to being waited on any longer. It made him uneasy, and something in his voice tipped off Marianne, who laughed, teasing, asking who'd been cooking for him lately, a girl? And Patrick blushed and said no one. Marianne smiled. No? It was true, in a way. No one had cooked for Patrick here, in his own kitchen. They sat down to eat. Marianne's minestrone was the most delicious soup Patrick had ever tasted, steaming hot in stoneware bowls, a thick broth seasoned with fresh basil and oregano, containing chunks of celery, tomato, carrots, red onion, beans, chickpeas, and macaroni. The 9-grain whole wheat bread was crumbly, chewy, delicious, too. And a green salad with red leaf lettuce and endive, cucumber, pepper, alfalfa sprouts, a vinegar and oil dressing flavored with dill. Patrick was surprised at his appetite, his hunger. Usually, he prepared for himself quick meals out of cans, dumped in a pan or stir-fried in a skillet. Marianne had always been slender, small-boned. She'd eaten sparingly, as she ate now, taking pleasure in Patrick's appetite and his reactions to her meal. "Wow, terrific! This is really good!" Marianne blushed. Like Corinne, she was uneasy receiving praise, saying disparagingly, "I think I put too much oregano in the soup. If it's overdone..." "Hell no," Patrick said severely. "It's perfect." Marianne smiled, laughed nervously. In the overhead light, her eyes were enormous and the sockets deeply shadowed. Patrick reiterated how happy he was at Cornell, how rarely he was lonely. Marianne's wistful smile seemed to inquire, "But don't you miss me?" He took no notice. He was feeling rather boastful, a quiet boy running at the mouth, in the way of stiff, shy, vain young men who imagine themselves brilliant and are so perceived by others. He spoke warmly, if vaguely, of his fellow tenants in the house, foreign students so much more serious than most American students. Civilization for them was a very different matter than it was for Americans, Patrick believed. "We tend to take it for granted, it's just there. We tend to think it's for us, a gift. But others, from the East especially, seem to know something else. Almost when you talk with them, Patrick said earnestly, you get the impression they're shielding us. I mean, a kid like me. Typical spoiled American kid like me.
Oh, Patrick, Marianne laughed with sisterly reproach, you're hardly typical.
Patrick said loftily, I don't want to be. But I see the world through the prism of my culture, not through objective eyes.
But why would anyone else be more objective? I don't understand.
Because their civilizations are older, more fatalistic. It's like contingency in evolutionary theory. Sheer chance. There seems to be design. In fact, it's ingenious design. No mere human brain could have devised it. There seems to be intelligence manifested. But it's the accidental, mechanical accumulation of natural selection over a period of millions of years. No God, only just nature. An accident.
Patrick spoke dogmatically in the tone of Dr. Herring in the lecture hall. Marianne was sitting meekly hunched at the table, bone-sharp elbows on the table, eyes downcast and forehead creased. She'd virtually stopped eating.
Shyly, she said, My friend Abelov, that's his last name, he's called by his last name, he's executive director of the co-op, he says that evolution and creation can be reconciled. Evolution through nature and creation through God? Don't be silly, Patrick said, snorting in derision.
I'm not sure how to explain it. I'm sure you aren't. It's just that there are different ways of perceiving the same thing, Marianne said uncertainly. I mean, aren't there?
There are scientifically demonstrable ways and there are superstitious, self-deluding ways, Patrick said curtly. You can choose one or the other, but not both.
Marianne stood from the table shakily. Patrick thought she was going to walk away, but instead she went to slice more bread. He'd eaten all the slices she'd laid out. When Marianne returned to the table, Patrick made an effort to speak more moderately.
Really, he wasn't a bully, so hot-headed. He'd be ashamed of himself afterward. It was pinch instinct, screwing up his face like a spoiled brat.
There were excellent reasons why people like his sister and his mother and her mother, in fact, most of humanity, believed what they believed in the face of reason itself. They believed because, like children, they were terrified of the dark, mistaking the luminosity of an inhuman and implacable truth for mere dark. Marianne was an avid listener as Patrick spoke of his courses, his professors, his work. She didn't inquire into his grades, but Patrick informed her. All A's, through 3 semesters of 5 3-credit courses each, except for goddamned organic chemistry where he'd managed only an A-minus, in a pack of pre-med majors, some of whom were rumored to have cheated on the final. Well, not only on the final. But Patrick, flush-faced, indignant, didn't want to go into that. The cheating, dishonesty, cynicism, beer-drinking, drug-taking, sexual promiscuity of his undergraduate classmates. Not all, but a sizable percentage. No, Patrick didn't want to go into that. Instead, he told Marianne of his hopes for a career. After his BA, he would enter a PhD program, possibly here at Cornell, where he could work with Maynard Herring, one of the most distinguished of living microbiologists, who'd already singled out Patrick Mulvaney as bright, promising. He would win a fellowship, or if not a fellowship, a teaching assistantship. He would complete his PhD in 3 years, if all goes as planned. Patrick continued to speak, not knowing what he said or why, at this moment, he was driven to say it. The words long pent up, the solitude of his life erupting suddenly in a passion he hadn't known he possessed. Marianne moved quietly and surely, clearing the table, rinsing the dishes, all the while listening to Patrick. She was happy, her soul shining in her deep-socketed eyes. Last time Patrick had spoken with his mother on the phone, mentioning Marianne's upcoming visit to Ithaca, Corinne said evasively, guiltily,
Oh, give Marianne our love. She's doing very well at that little college. She'll make a wonderful teacher, I'm sure. Judd and I are going to drive down some weekend soon.
A pause and a choked, pleading voice. Hon, I wouldn't interfere with your sister if I were you, and
Patrick said coolly, Yes, but you aren't me, Mom, and I'm not you. What secrets lay between them, Mom and Button, mother and daughter?
just possibly none.
Would he die for Marianne? Yes, he believed he would. Yet, had he ever confronted Zachary Lunt or any of the pack of guys who were Zachary's friends and who, it was rumored, would stand up for Zach if the police investigated? No, he had not. That wasn't Patrick's way. That wasn't Pinch's way. Aloof and furious and deeply unspeakably hurt. Nor had he confronted his father, with whom, since February 1976, he'd scarcely spoken. You go your way and I go mine. His father seemed to him mad. It was pointless to talk to him, still less argue. He'd banished Marianne from the household and from his life so that he could banish her from his thoughts. It was simple as that, and Patrick understood. He understood, but couldn't forgive. To Corinne, he said, "It's cruel, it's ridiculous, I hate him. How can you?" And Corinne said angrily, "You don't hate your father, Patrick. You know that. As for Marianne, she's happy and she's adjusted. Her faith sustains her just as it sustains me. Don't interfere." But Pinch would interfere, if only at a distance. He wanted to believe her. She insisted she was happy. Didn't want to sit staring at her, trying to figure out what was her life now. Life after high school. Cheerleader. Prom princess. He didn't want to interrogate her, yet had to ask. How had her first semester at Kilburn gone? And when, another time, she told him with girlish enthusiasm, plucking at her shorn hair, how happy she was at the college, how much she'd been learning in her classes, especially a course in American history, focusing upon the abolitionist movement, readings in Thoreau, Emerson, Frederick Douglass, Patrick interrupted to ask, "But Marianne, how did you do? I mean, your grades?" Crude, blunt Pinch. Marianne had been smiling, and now her smile faltered. Her bruised-looking eyelids began to flutter, so like Corinne's. Is there a gene for such related mannerisms? Or are they purely learned, conditioned? She said quietly, so quietly Patrick almost couldn't hear, "I didn't exactly complete two of the courses. I had to take incompletes."
"Why?"
"Well," Marianne squirmed, pulling at her spiky hair, "things sort of came up, suddenly."
"What kind of things?"
"An emergency at the co-op just after Thanksgiving. Aviva, who was assistant store manager, got sick."
"Store? What store?"
"Oh, Patrick, I must have told you, didn't I? In Kilburn, in town, we have a Green Isle outlet. We sell preserves, fresh produce in the summer, baked goods. My zucchini walnut bread is one of the favorites.
And you work in this store? How many hours a week?"
Marianne dipped her head, avoiding Patrick's interrogative gaze. "We don't think in terms of hours, exactly," she said. She was sitting on Patrick's sofa, not an item from home, part of the dull, spare, slightly shabby furnishings of the apartment, while Patrick sat facing her in a rather overbearing position on his desk chair, his right ankle balanced on his left knee in a posture both relaxed and aggressive, thinking Pinch-style, "I have a right to ask. Who else will ask if I don't?"
"What terms do you think in, then?"
"The Green Isle Co-op isn't a formally run organization like a business. It's more like a family. People helping each other out. From each what he or she can give, to each as he or she requires."
"Who said that? P.T. Barnum?"
"Oh, Patrick, no." Dutifully, Marianne laughed at Patrick's adolescent sarcasm, as a sister must. For an instant, they were 12 and 13 years old, and Pinch was being dourly witty at the supper table. "It's the co-op motto. It's Abelove's, derived from some 19th century philosopher, I think."
"Karl Marx."
"Whoever." Marianne smiled anxiously, forehead creased. Since Patrick had picked her up at the depot, she'd been plucking at her hair, half-consciously, stroking the nape of her neck as if it were tender and ached, groping to make sure the flimsy straps of her T-shirt were in place. You would wonder, Patrick would wonder, why a young woman of 19 would wear such a shirt and nothing beneath it. Why, when it was only just April in upstate New York and far from summer. And why the pebble-colored slacks with the elastic waist in so synthetic a fabric it had no weave at all, smooth as formica, slacks that might have been bought in a bargain basement children's department. I am so small and inconsequential, please don't be angry at me. But Patrick was angry, bristling with anger. He said, "From each, what he or she can give? Sure. Who's helping you?" "But Patrick, you're clerking in a store? You're baking bread? What else?"
"Patrick, these people are my friends. You'll have to come visit us. Maybe the weekend Mom and Judd drive down. Kilburn is a small place, the town and the college, nothing like Cornell. No one is suspicious of anyone else there. No one would cheat, for instance."
Patrick let this pass. He listened in silence as Marianne spoke of how she'd been approached by some of the Green Isle people on her second day at Kilburn. She'd been wandering in the bookstore sort of lost and confused. To tell the truth, she'd been almost crying. The textbooks cost so much, even the used textbooks. And the first thing Felice Marie and Burke said was, "Hey, don't worry. There's probably some of these books out at the house. We have a library. You can use ours." She spoke of the wonderful old house that had once been the Kilburn Inn, going back to stagecoach times. The greenhouses they'd restored to almost perfect condition. The pear orchards, meadows, fertile soil. Mom would love. She spoke of the co-op membership, currently 23, of whom 18 lived in the house. They had a single bank account. They pooled all their finances, if they worked outside the co-op, as sometimes Marianne did, shelving books in the college library. They pooled their earnings. Green Isle was synonymous with honor system. Green Isle was a communal oasis in an American capitalist consumer desert. These were Abelove's words, reverently quoted. In just 5 years since the Green Isle co-op had been founded by Abelove, it had acquired an excellent local reputation and many loyal customers at the store. In fact, Kilburn State was itself a customer. Abelove had negotiated a contract with the food services department. Patrick resisted his pinch instinct and asked casually, politely, about Abelove. And of course Marianne spoke warmly at length, describing this wonderful, dedicated person with a wonderful, kindly sense of humor. A musician, guitar, banjo, an artist, clay sculpting, an organic gardener, no artificial fertilizers or insecticides, but primarily an intellectual, a theorist with advanced degrees in psychology and anthropology. Abelove had been an assistant professor at Kilburn who'd become disillusioned with the straitjacket conformity of the academic world. He'd dropped out to found the Green Isle Co-op, a private vision he'd had as an idealistic teenager camping alone on Mount Katahdin, which is somewhere in Maine. Patrick interrupted to ask, "How old is this person?"
"Old?
Why, I don't know. In his early 30s, maybe?" "I'd guess he just didn't get tenure at Kilburn State. That's why he dropped out. And where are his advanced degrees from, do you know?"
Marianne plucked at her hair, trying to recall. "Somewhere in Boston, I think."
"Harvard?"
The question was very lightly, ironically put.
Marianne missed the tone and said, "Yes, I think, maybe.
One of them, at least.
Actually, Abelove won't talk about himself. Things are known about him. People talk about him because they admire him so, but he rarely talks about himself."
Patrick said stiffly, "The Green Isle isn't some sort of ridiculous cult, is it? And Abelove some sort of megalomaniac guru?"
"Oh, Patrick, no."
Patrick sucked at his lower lip. "Harvard, really? He very much doubted Harvard." He said irritably,
"Well, is there a religion involved? Do you all worship together?"
Marianne said, hurt, "You know I have my own religion, Patrick. I've been attending a wonderful little church in Kilburn. Actually, it's outside of Kilburn a few miles, the Church of the Apostles. It's a farm community congregation. Mom would love Reverend Hooker and his wife, who's the free spirit type. Sort of like Mom, in fact.
Patrick interrupted. "Marianne, what happened to your courses last semester? You're in Kilburn to study and get a degree, aren't you? Not to work for this co-op as an indentured servant."
"But I have to help out if there are emergencies," Marianne said pleadingly. "It happened so unexpectedly. Poor Aviva had some sort of breakdown. She just disappeared from the house. We didn't know where she'd gone. I mean, at first. I volunteered to take over her duties, and of course I had my own. And my classes, and, well,
Things got complicated.
Marianne paused, smiling at Patrick. She was sitting with her legs drawn up beneath her in what could not have been a very comfortable position.
I only just did what anyone would do, Patrick, in such circumstances.
Patrick let this pass.
Are you making up those courses now, this semester? Well, not exactly.
What's that mean, no?
Marianne said softly. I'm going to enroll in summer school in about 6 weeks. The dean of students has been very understanding.
You mean you're not taking classes now?
Well, no, I just haven't had time with so much.
You've dropped out of school? God, Marianne!
I haven't dropped out. Didn't I just say I'm going to enroll in summer school? Why are you so angry, Patrick? I don't get angry at you.
Wait, those incompletes are on your transcripts now as Fs, aren't they? If you didn't make them up?
Marianne sat wordless, plucking at her hair.
Patrick sighed heavily, removing his glasses, rubbed his eyes roughly. But what point in anger, really?
Wouldn't interfere with your sister if I were you.
Strange, Patrick thought. He, Patrick Mulvaney, was this young woman's brother. They'd been brother and sister through all of their conscious lives. Each was more closely related to the other genetically than either was to either of their parents. Yet he believed he scarcely knew Marianne at all. He loved her, but scarcely knew her. Members of a family who've lived together in the heated intensity of family life scarcely know one another. Life is too head-on, too close up. That was the paradox. That was the bent, perplexing thing. Exactly the opposite of what you'd expect. For, of course, you never give such relationships a thought, living them. To give a thought, to take a thought, is a function of dissociation, distance. You can't exercise memory until you've removed yourself from memory's source. An image of a broken cobweb glistening sticky across his knuckles came to Patrick. As he'd walked through the tall grass behind the horse's barn, once you see a web in such a way, it's too late. It's no longer a web. It was late, past 10 o'clock. Not late by Patrick's usual schedule, but it felt late. The visit with Marianne had drained so much energy from both. Yet, unpredictably, Marianne jumped up from the sofa, saying she had a surprise for Patrick she had almost forgotten. She'd brought dessert, lemon tarts from Kilburn, another of her specialties. Patrick protested he wasn't hungry, but found himself eating 3 of the tarts. Marianne picked sparingly at hers, eating crumbs and licking her fingers. Her sallow complexion glowed as Patrick complimented her.
You never made anything like this at home, did you? Terrific.
Marianne began to speak, not quite coherently, of the last time Corinne had called. Easter Sunday it had been, in the evening. She'd called at the co-op, and Marianne picked up the phone herself. What a surprise. What a wonderful surprise. To pick up a ringing phone, just knowing it can't be for me, it would never be for me. And such knowledge, completely matter-of-fact, not at all disturbing. And it was Corinne. It was Mom. With a just perceptible air of childish pride, Marianne said, We talked for a long time, 40 minutes. And before she hung up, Mom said, just out of nowhere, If Dad was home right now, Marianne, I think maybe he'd like to speak with you. I didn't know what to say. I was so scared. Mom said, Marianne, are you listening? And I said, yes. And she said, it might be Easter. It might be just the time. I shouldn't talk like this, maybe. I'm just guessing, but it's what I think. So I asked if I should call them later that night when Dad got home. When should I call? And Mom started crying, I think. I think she was crying. And I was crying. Marianne laughed, shaking her head. Her deep, socketed eyes glistened with tears. Oh, Patrick, it was so wonderful. I couldn't sleep all that night.
Patrick thought, don't say a word.
Patrick stood, almost overturning his chair. Marianne cowered before him, seeing something terrible in his face.
Dad! How can you call him Dad? He's a blind, selfish man. He's cruel. He's crazy. The way he's treated you, crazy. Why care about him or her? Let him go.
Patrick slammed out of the room, into his bedroom, blindly. Didn't know what he was doing, couldn't believe his anger. It had erupted so suddenly, out of where? Immediately, he was ashamed of himself. Why frighten Marianne, his sister? To what purpose saying such things to her?
she to whom such a filthy thing had happened.
The terrifying possibility came to Patrick. Our lives are not our own, but in the possession of others, our parents. Our lives are defined by the whims, caprices, cruelties of others. That genetic web, the ties of blood, it was the oldest curse, older than God. Am I loved? Am I wanted? Who will want me if my parents don't? No, bullshit.
It was very quiet. Patrick, badly trembling, sat down hard on his bed, flat, lumpy mattress, threw off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. He tried to calm himself. He was not one to give in to emotion. Hadn't a girl called him icy cold not long ago, and the very words had thrilled him?
Damn you, Pinch, why interfere? Your sister has Jesus Christ, she doesn't need you.
How she'd stared at him when he'd shouted at her, cowering, shrinking. Patrick had intended that Marianne sleep in this room, in his bed. He would sleep on the sofa, uncomfortable as that would be. He changed the sheets, plumped up the Singo pillow, which was a goose feather pillow from home. The room was hardly larger than a closet, space enough for the bed, a bureau of drawers, a wicker stool he'd brought from home, painted robin's egg blue. Patrick halfway expected Marianne to knock timidly on his door, but there was no knock, no sound at all from the other room. He went out to discover his sister nodding off on the sofa, limp-limbed, her head drooping and swaying. The skin of her face was waxy white and looked tight as the skin of a drum. Her mouth was slack, her eyelids fluttering. Of course, poor Marianne was exhausted. She traveled hours by bus. She'd had to wait for Patrick in the depot. She'd made supper. She'd cleared and washed the dishes. She'd endured her brother's self-besotted talk all evening. Patrick went to get Corinne's rag quilt after all from where he'd hidden it. Why not? It was warm. It was beautiful. It even smelled faintly of the dried potpourri Corinne tossed into drawers at home, like a secret blessing. He covered Marianne with the quilt, tucking it around her shoulders. He switched off the overhead light, but stood for a while watching her in the dim light of the other room, as if guarding her. How could Patrick put his sister back on the Trailways bus tomorrow afternoon at 5:20 p.m.? How could he surrender her to whatever was there in Kilburn, in the Green Isle Co-op? Yet he knew he was going to. You have no choice, Pinch instructed himself. You have your own life.
I need your help, Judd.
Or possibly he said, I need help, Judd.
The words ran through me like an electric current. No one had ever uttered such words to me in earnest. Until you have heard such uttered to you by someone you love and are bound to by ties of blood and memory, you can't know how powerful, how thrilling they are. Help. I need your help. Your help, Judd.
Always, when Patrick called home, it was to tell us, inform us of nothing. His life in Ithaca was private, and we weren't to inquire. Almost shyly, Mom would ask if Patrick might be coming home to visit sometime soon, or when. And Dad had learned to be as polite and impersonal to Patrick as Patrick was to him. If there was something Patrick wanted us to know, he might mention it just before hanging up, as an afterthought. He'd been awarded a summer research grant, he'd made another 4.0 grade average, he was just recovering from an attack of winter flu. If you asked Patrick a direct question, he'd nimbly sidestep, murmur something you couldn't quite hear, maybe yes, maybe no, maybe undecided. I'd about reconciled myself. No brothers. Where once I'd had two big brothers, now none. Thinking, I don't particularly like Pinch anyway. The hell with Pinch. It wasn't often that Patrick spoke with me on the phone, but when he did, he'd usually talk in a light, bantering, slightly distracted way, calling me Ranger or Kid, but as if his mind was on something else. Maybe I'd call him PJ. It wasn't up to me to break through to anything deeper. If I wanted to ask about Marianne, had he spoken with her recently, had he seen her, I'd feel shy about bringing up the subject. I'd have to wait for the right moment, and maybe the moment wouldn't come. This time, though, when Patrick called, and it was late, after 11 p.m. of a weekday. I picked up the phone on the first ring, just happened to be downstairs in the family room switching through TV channels, volume low so Mom upstairs in bed wouldn't hear, and right away he was serious, none of the pinch crap. First thing he asked was, "Do you think anyone else is on the line?" And I'm surprised as hell. I say, "What? Who?" Because it could only be Mom or Dad, as far as Patrick would know. He couldn't have known that Dad was in Marcina on business, staying the night. So right away, Patrick backs off a little, saying he just wanted to be sure. And there's this beat or two. Just silence. I'm holding the receiver to my ear, not hearing a thing. I wonder if he's hung up. "Patrick? Something wrong?" His voice comes low and mean, like he's angry with me. "There's lots of things wrong." "You mean about Dad?" This is a week after Dad tossed his beer into the judge's face. In front of 12 witnesses in the Yankee Doodle taproom of the Mount Ephraim Country Club. And he'd been arrested and taken to Mount Ephraim Police Headquarters and booked for assault and disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. There'd been quite a struggle when police officers came to pick him up. And District Judge Gerald Kirkland isn't going to drop the charges because he's angry as hell at my father and we don't know if Dad will be going to jail. He could be put away as long as 2 years. Or if he'll get a suspended sentence and a fine. And if it's a fine, how much? The Monday morning after the arrest, there was delivered to Michael Mulvaney Sr. at High Point Farm a certified letter containing a formal notification from the Mount Ephraim Country Club, signed by each of the club's 20 trustees, revoking his membership and, by extension, all rights and privileges of said membership as had been enjoyed by the family of Michael Mulvaney Sr. The expelled members' annual dues of $600, paid in full for 1978-79, were returned to him in full, in the same envelope. As Mom said bitterly, not once but many times, "What the hell do we care?" Now Patrick says these words that shake me up. "I need your help, Judd." It isn't just the word help that's such a surprise, coming from my brother. It's my name, Judd. My real name, and not Ranger or Kid. As if, in this instant, we're equals. I'm cautious. I wonder if I've heard right. What kind of help, Patrick? He sounds angry, as if I should know. Executing justice. Taking care of, you know, Lunt. Zachary Lunt. I mean, I'll do it. Patrick speaks carefully, but his words seem disconnected, as if he's been drinking. It's the way Dad talks when he's been drinking, if he talks to us at all. "I'll be the one, but I need your help. Judd?" "Yeah?" "Dad still got his guns?" "His guns? Or Mike, that 22 of Mike's locked in the cabinet, you know?" I'm holding the phone receiver, and I'm starting to sweat, sick with fear and excitement. Patrick's saying, "The 22, could you get it?" "Get it? For Christ's sake, Judd, you sound like a parrot," Patrick laughs. It's obvious now, and this scares me as much as what he's been saying, that he's been drinking. "Oh, shit, never mind. Patrick, wait. Forget I called, it's the wrong goddamn time, it's..." There's a sound like he's dropped the phone receiver, he's scrambling to pick it up again. "Not the right time yet, fuck it." Next I know, he's hung up. And I'm sitting there on the sofa, staring at a corner of the ceiling, my brain numb and empty of all thought, as if I've been hit over the head with a sledgehammer. 3 days later, Patrick calls again. And Patrick says to me, sort of quick and breezy, "So, how's it going, kid?" And I shrug as if he can see me. I'm blinking tears out of my eyes. I feel so rotten. "Okay, I guess." And Patrick says, "It's really bad there, like Mom says. They're gonna sell the farm, you think so?" And I mumble something, maybe yes, maybe no, and Patrick says, "The other night, Judd, what I said..." And there's a pause, and I'm waiting for him to say, "Forget it, please. That was crazy talk," but instead I hear him saying, "I meant it, I'm gonna do it. Execute justice. I don't know when, but sometime. And I need you, okay?" And I'm trying to get my breath, trying to smile, act normal, since Mom's close by at the sink, whistling under her breath. "Sure, Patrick, any time." And Patrick says in his low, anxious voice, "Judd, you're the only person I can trust in the world." And I'm saying, stammering, "Well, that's good." And Patrick says, "I just need to get in focus about it. I'm not ready right now. My mind is not ready right now."
And I say that sick feeling in my gut, scared but excited, trembling.
Okay, Patrick, I'm your man.
In this way, I became, at the age of 16, a sophomore in high school, an accomplice to my brother Patrick's premeditated crime. I was what you'd call an accessory before the fact and an accessory after the fact. I was what you'd call a co-conspirator. I became an accomplice not at the time of our initial conversation, nor at the time of the second, when Patrick confided in me that I was the only person in the world he could trust, but in the interim between the conversations. In a trance of several days, day and night, thinking, whatever he wants, I'll do it. If he wants me to pull the trigger myself, I'll do it. I believed I'd always known that Zachary Lunt would have to be punished. I thought it would happen the way lightning strikes, that someone would do it. My father or Mike Jr. I hadn't thought that Patrick would do it, or that I would be involved. Me? Judd? But as soon as Patrick confided in me, I understood that Patrick was the only Mulvaney capable of executing justice in the way it required execution. Not as a sudden, impulsive act of violence, like wildfire springing up to consume us all, but as a coolly premeditated act from which the perpetrator would walk away unscathed. For nothing less than perfect would satisfy Patrick. There wasn't an hour in all the hours to come between my decision in early December 1978 and the execution itself in March 1979 that I once thought of not helping Patrick, of backing out, telling him I'd changed my mind, I was scared or disapproving. I thought it would be dangerous. I thought we could both be hurt. But I never thought, no, I can't do it, I won't.
Mainly what I'll need from you, Judd, is one of the guns, from out of Dad's cabinet.
I murmured, yeah, all right.
One of them is Dad's 12-gauge Browning shotgun I've never fired. I held it once in my hands, though. It's heavy, lethal, double-barreled. It could blow a man's head off at close range. Also, there's the 22-caliber Winchester rifle of Mike's, remember? He got me to shoot it a few times. Target practice back of the barns. I remember Mike was surprised I actually hit the target. Beginner's luck, he said.
I didn't remember this. I'd have been too young. My brothers wouldn't have wanted me tagging after them. Or maybe it had never happened. I had the idea if I telephoned Mike at the Marine base in Florida, he'd laugh and deny it.
What, pinch? Blind in one eye? He couldn't hit the broadside of a barn.
Patrick was saying, marveling,
it's strange to be talking like this, Judd, isn't it? But it seems right. I've been more at peace since I've started planning what has to be done. Other things that used to crowd my mind, make me anxious and keep me awake, they've fallen into perspective now. They've lost significance. Is it the same way with you?
I murmured, I guess so, right. If I spoke so aloud, it must have been true.
Patrick said, I couldn't go on with my life until justice is executed, until our enemy is punished.
Each time Patrick spoke with me on the phone, through December, January, February, his plan for the execution of justice seemed more defined, elaborate. It was as if, away in Ithaca, he was contemplating a map on his wall, the details of which he could only hint at to me. He had scheduled the execution for April at Easter when he assumed Zachary Lunt would be home in Mount Ephraim. Patrick's plan was to surprise Zachary after dark, take him away at gunpoint, preferably in Zachary's own car. There was a place Patrick would force Zachary to drive. He wasn't sure he wanted me to know where just yet, didn't want me incriminated unnecessarily, where they would be isolated and where whatever was to happen would happen.
I'll demand from him an acknowledgement of guilt. Yes, he raped my sister. Yes, he's a rapist and a liar. He's evil and deserves to be punished.
Judd, you're still there?
I said, sure, Patrick.
Gripping the telephone receiver so tight, my knuckles were waxy white.
You'll get Mike's gun from me, won't you? You'll bring it to me. And some ammunition, just in case. Somewhere we won't be seen. I can't be seen. Anywhere near Mount Ephraim, I mean. I'll need to be in two places at once because I can't be caught, and what I'm going to do can't be repeated. It's an experiment that can be performed only once.
Patrick spoke in measured, thoughtful sentences. He was both my older brother PJ, whom I adored and feared, and someone I didn't know, whose face I could not imagine except for the squinty left eye, the glasses shoved against the bridge of his nose.
You'll have to unlock Dad's cabinet with his key. You can't force it. If you force the lock, well, you can't. We'll find some other means of getting a gun.
I was staring at the shadowy corner of the room where Dad's cabinet was. One of Mom's antiques with a glass front, made of a hardwood riddled with knots like eyes. I told Patrick, yes. I swallowed hard, told Patrick I wasn't afraid. I would do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted.
It's a matter of simple coordination. You'll meet me at X and you deliver the gun and ammunition. Mike's 22, my good luck rifle. The only gun I've ever fired. You return home immediately and you stay home and you're totally uninvolved. Next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me. You can pick up the rifle at Y and return it to the cabinet. It won't be fired, I'm sure. If I realize I have to, well, kill him, hurt him, I'll use a knife. Just an ordinary steak knife. I'll buy one weeks ahead of time at a hardware store here. Just a knife. Something that can't be traced. But I might not hurt him, actually. Unless it happens. He'll be a coward. He'll beg for his life. He won't put up a fight. I know him. I know all of them, Zachary Lunt and his friends. They were going to lie about Marianne to protect him. I wish I could punish all of them, but I can't. Not just his friends, but his father, too. And Dad's friends.
The bitter intonation of friends. The way Patrick spoke the word curled his lip in disgust like Dad. I whispered agreement. My voice was quavering. I felt a deep, shuddering thrill as of someone in love, the first terrible time when you don't know it's love. I thought, I have a brother. I am a brother. This is what it is to be brothers.
You raped my sister, he would say. He would accuse, you raped my sister, you destroyed my family.
At gunpoint, holding his cringing, cowering enemy,
did you think you would never be punished?
That winter, except on the most bitterly cold, windswept days, Patrick ran for miles. He was too restless to stay in his room for very long, nor even to work at the lab as he'd once done, lost in concentration, staring down into the magnified, teeming world of microorganisms. He'd grown impatient with that world which had so little to do with his own, that anonymity, so without mind or purpose save its own infinite replication. Running revealed to him such truths. Each moment in time has been one of wonder and dread and not knowing. At the end of March, from a public telephone in Ithaca, Patrick called the Lunts in Mount Ephraim. It was 5 in the afternoon of a weekday. A woman answered on the 4th ring. Patrick introduced himself as a high school friend of Zachary's, naming a name, Don Maitland, that might sound plausible to Mrs. Lunt, for there was, in fact, a Don Maitland who'd been on the periphery of Zachary's circle, and Patrick guessed the young men wouldn't be in contact, not after several years. Patrick asked for Zachary's address, telephone number, and so forth, and Mrs. Lunt provided the information readily enough. Yes, he was at sunny Binghamton. Yes, studying business administration. No, he wouldn't be graduating this year. He'd taken a couple of semesters off, but he was serious now, working very hard, and she and her husband expected Zachary to get his degree, possibly as early as next spring. Mrs. Lunt was pleasant-voiced, polite enough to ask Don Maitland how he was, what he was doing, and Patrick provided a plausible response. Don Maitland, too, had dropped out of school for a while, but was back now, at Oswego Tech, studying electrical engineering. He asked, will Zachary be home over spring break, around Easter? And Mrs. Lunt said, certainly, yes. And Patrick said, great, us guys can all get together then, like last time. And Mrs. Lunt said, with a mild motherly laugh, I'm sure you will. One night in early April, 15 days before he planned to drive to Mount Ephraim to confront Zachary Lunt, Patrick woke terrified from a nightmare of what? Quicksand dragging at his legs, seething, steaming black muck getting into his nose, his mouth, into his eyes. He leapt from bed, stumbled and fell, his heart pounding. He was sobbing like a child. No, no, help! What is it? Leave me alone! He'd confused his damp, twisted bedclothes with black muck. Yet it seemed his bed was black muck, liquidy as melted tar, roofing tar, the tar his dad used, yet living, a living organism, seething and sucking at Patrick Mulvaney, greedy to pull him down inside it. He switched on his bedside lamp with shaking fingers, stared at the alarm clock, not registering the time at first, 4:35 a.m., and rain,
rain blown against his windows, a chilly draft from the window now that it was April and Patrick had removed the masking tape he'd been using as insulation. Now it was officially nearing spring, the landlord at 114 Cook was more grudging with heat. Patrick's room was as cold as if it were winter. Yet he'd been sweating in his sleep, in such terror of being suffocated. He wiped at his eyes, imagining lashes were stuck together with black muck. Christ, how disgusting. It must be nerves, that was all. Yet Patrick was certain he hadn't any nerves, really. His plan for the execution of justice was complete except for a few minor details. Nothing could deter him. He'd vowed he'd be willing to trade his life, if necessary, in order to execute justice against his sister's rapist. Nothing could deter him. Patrick went out into the bathroom in the hall, used the toilet, and splashed handfuls of cold water onto his face. There were his eyes, finely threaded with blood, seemingly enlarged without his glasses, regarding him in the splotched mirror above the sink. Were those the eyes of a 21-year-old capable of murder? Patrick smiled at himself, saying, "Yeah, right." Back in his apartment, Patrick stood for a while at his window, fearful of returning to bed. The sheets would be damp and twisted, smelling of animal panic. That unmistakable sweat smell. He thought of Judd, a casualty too of Zachary Lunt's rape of Marianne. The poor kid stuck at High Point Farm in its waning, disintegrating days. He and Mike had cleared out, and Marianne was exiled, and Judd, the baby of the family, was left behind. In the past several months, in these nighttime telephone conversations, Patrick had grown closer to Judd than to anyone else in the world, except maybe Marianne. He loved Marianne intensely, but with Marianne you didn't speak directly, couldn't speak the kind of truth a brother could speak to another brother. Strange. Growing up with Judd, Patrick hadn't taken him seriously. Almost he'd never looked at him. A kid brother is just someone who's there. Difficult to think of a kid brother as an individual with a life, his own secret thoughts, motives. But now, at the age of 16, Judd wasn't a child any longer, and he'd become Patrick's friend and ally. Patrick liked him very much, and respected him for his integrity and courage. Respecting a kid brother. What a novelty. Yet Patrick wondered if, living together at High Point Farm, face to face, always, as in any family, competing for the attention of their father and mother, they'd be capable of such frankness and intimacy as the telephone allowed. Sitting now at his desk, paper shoved aside, head which ached dully in his hands, Jesus, what a close escape. Almost suffocated in that black muck. It had been, possibly, tar, molten tar, the tar he'd worked with summers on Dad's roofing crews. But it was also, he seemed to see, a bog off Route 58 going toward Uville, that dismal, swampy area where a shallow creek emptied into the Uville River north of Mount Ephraim. Cattails and jungle vines and those brilliant purple wildflowers. Phlox? Loosestrife? Grew there in profusion in summer, but most of the trees had been dying for years as the water table rose, bark peeling off their trunks in tatters. At any hour of the day, patches of sickly mist hovered over the bog. There was a pervasive odor of rot, of sewage. Just possibly raw hog sewage seeped into the bog from a large corporate farm a few miles away. As a boy, Patrick had never explored the bog, nor had anyone he knew. It was much too far to have bicycled to from High Point Farm. Even in bright sunshine, it retained a look of sinister desolation. In warm weather, it was teeming with birds, frogs, water snakes, insects, microorganisms in unfathomable numbers. Now, in April, in the spring thaw, the liquidy black muck would be stirring into life after its long winter hibernation. Jesus, Patrick shuddered, feeling a pang of nausea. He rubbed his eyes where something was sticking to his lashes. He won't want it, maybe. This is just to test me. Noon of April 16th, the Saturday before Easter Sunday, 1979, the brothers met at the spot Patrick had designated, an unpaved stretch of Stone Creek Road near a railroad embankment 10 miles east of Eagleton Corners. The area was mainly scrubland, no houses. In deer hunting season, men in fluorescent orange hunter's dickies came in carloads to prowl through the woods, but it wasn't deer hunting season now. When Patrick drove up in his battered, mud-splotched Jeep,
There was Judd anxiously waiting in the Ford pickup with a .22 caliber Winchester rifle wrapped in a strip of canvas on the passenger seat beside him. Judd's heart lifted at the sight of his brother, whom he hadn't seen for some time. If this was a test of Judd's loyalty and faith in Patrick, he knew he'd done well. So far as Corinne knew, Judd was on an errand to a farm supply store in Eagleton Corners. Neither Corinne nor Michael Sr. had any idea that Patrick was anywhere near home. Patrick slowed the Jeep, but continued past the turnoff where the pickup was parked. Deftly turned in the road and drove back to park close by Judd, facing the opposite direction. He swung open his door as Judd opened his, but neither brother climbed out of his vehicle. In these quick, confused seconds, Judd had absorbed the significant fact that both the front and rear license plates of Patrick's Jeep were partly obscured by mud.
"How's it going, kid?" Patrick asked.
The voice was not Patrick's voice.
From their many telephone conversations, Judd had come to know Patrick's voice as intimately as his own, but this voice, loud, aggressively cheerful, was not that voice.
Chill sunshine fell from directly overhead through the Jeep's not very clean windshield and onto Patrick's pale, sharp-chiseled face. He looked older, scarcely recognizable. He was wearing wire-rimmed sunglasses so dark as to appear black, and his jaws were covered in whiskers of approximately a week's growth. He was wearing an army fatigue jacket, and his hair was completely hidden beneath a dark woolen cap pulled down low on his forehead. Judd stared, fascinated.
"What's wrong, kid? Don't you know your old brother Pinch?" Patrick seemed pleased.
"You do look sort of different."
"That's my intention."
"Well, I brought what you wanted."
"Great, give it here."
Stone Creek Road was empty of traffic in both directions, so far as Judd could see. He handed Patrick the rifle and its canvas wrapper, and Patrick examined it on his lap behind the steering wheel. He stroked the polished stock and drew his finger slowly along the long, slender barrel. He lifted the rifle to his shoulder, aimed it beyond Judd's head, frowning through the scope. Judd steeled himself, preparing for Patrick to pull the trigger. Who knew if Mike's old rifle could even fire after so many years? Judd hadn't dared to test it himself. Patrick had said he didn't want the rifle fired, no evidence of recent use, if that could be avoided.
Weird. PJ with a beard. How Mom would laugh.
Though she'd say Patrick was handsome, too. Any new thing the brothers did, like Mike slicking his hair back oiled in high school, or PJ getting his round, wire-rimmed eyeglasses instead of those Mom had selected, she'd make a fuss initially, declaring she'd never get used to it. What an unsettling sight! Then come around after a few days to marveling how handsome her sons were after all. As if she'd made the choice, not them. And maybe she'd remember it. She had.
Judd was saying, "I was worried I wouldn't be able to locate the key to the cabinet, but it was in the kitchen drawer. Mom had tagged it Cabinet Family Room. Just like Mom." Patrick didn't reply. He was examining the rifle like a finicky customer. He'd opened it, peering at the bullets, extracted a bullet to hold it to the light. Judd saw, or believed he saw, that his brother's hands shook slightly. Patrick said, "Did you bring any more bullets?" Judd had forgotten. A box containing 24 bullets, never open, he'd found in one of the cabinet drawers.
"Oh yeah, here."
"I doubt I'll be using them, but..." Patrick smiled, taking the box from Judd. "You never know. Chance follows design, but not invariably."
"Chance follows design? What's that mean?"
"You make careful plans, and chance seems to favor you. Things go your way that look to a neutral observer like luck. But it's luck you've engineered."
"That sounds good."
"But not invariably. Because design can collapse, no matter how carefully it's been planned."
Patrick shut up the rifle, covered it with the canvas, and laid it on the seat beside him. Put the box of bullets into the Jeep's glove compartment. His movements were brisk, methodical. He was preparing to drive away. They'd been together scarcely 5 minutes. Judd felt a stab of panic. Wasn't there more to be said, explained? He thought, if it's only a test, it can end now. Patrick named another out-of-the-way location, about equidistant from Mount Ephraim and High Point Farm, where Judd could retrieve the rifle the next